This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we are dealing with family law generally, but we're focusing on dissolution of marriage and the situation where one divorcing spouse has hidden assets from the other. So hopefully we will tell you not how to do it, but how to find the assets. My guests are Yasmin Mehmet. She's a certified family law specialist, certified by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. She's a member of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar. Her offices are in San Francisco. My other guest is Lisa Jolicoeur, who is a CPA and also a forensic accountant who has offices in San Francisco. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, and by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Well, Yasmin and Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank
very,
you,
very nice to have you here. Would you start us off, please, Yasmin? What rights does a spouse who's going through a dissolution of marriage, or most people are perhaps are familiar with the older term divorce, what rights do they have to getting information with respect to the financial situation?
Well, a divorcing party actually has rights to a very broad range of information. And one of the things that happens in some marriages is that a lot of times people are not familiar with the level of their assets or the level of income of both parties. So they are only discovering some of this information for the very first time when they're getting divorced. And when parties are getting divorced, they have a responsibility which is extended throughout the marriage as a fiduciary duty, as a fiduciary for one another. And what that involves is a certain level of disclosure. And they have a duty to be essentially fair and have good faith with one another and not to take advantage of the other party. So there are a number of tools that the family code allows in order to get information from one spouse to the other.
All right. So where do you find in your practice that there are hidden assets? Is it basically when someone has a business and somehow they are in a way dealing with certain things in the business where they're not making full disclosure to the other spouse?
Well, the issue of disclosure can come up in a couple of contexts. One is if somebody is trying to determine what the level of income is of the parties in order to obtain, for example, a child or spousal support award. Mm-hmm. And then you're looking at the level of income from a variety of sources, not just from salary. It can be self-employment income. But the second context in which it arises is from the assets being divided and trying to determine what is within the community estate so that both parties can share equally in that community estate.
How often are there problems where someone comes into a marriage and the person has a separate property? Maybe this is a second marriage. One party has a home already from the first marriage, holds on to the home, and there's still a mortgage on it. And these people, the second marriage, they get married, and the person or persons, whatever the situation may be, part of that income that person is making is going toward paying the mortgage or deeds of trust on the property.
That's right. It often happens that people come into marriage with assets that they have accrued prior to marriage.
That's not a hidden asset, is it?
No, that's not a hidden asset.
How do you deal, just to distinguish that, because I think a lot of people could relate to that. How is that to be distinguished? Let me throw this to you, if you don't mind, Lisa. Mm-hmm. How is that to be distinguished from a hidden asset? I mean, obviously, someone comes into a marriage with their own home or whatever it may be. Maybe they have a condo they rent to some people and don't live there. There's a mortgage on the condo. Part of the payments on the mortgage go from whoever owns the condo, which that spouse, part of the payment on the mortgage is from that spouse's income, which of course is community property. How do you deal with that?
Correct.
Because I think people would be interested in that.
What a lot of people don't understand that is once you start taking community money to pay down a separate property debt on a piece of real estate, the community is now acquiring an ownership interest into that property. So sometimes that can be surprising to the separate property owner. And it's just a reality. If the community,
why would it be surprising though? I mean, they should have enough knowledge that to realize, hey,
well,
you know,
what
is it, finders keepers, losers reapers,
something like that. Because they end up relinquishing some of the property rights, and you know, it becomes, it's not a straightforward assumption. You have to. As a forensic accountant, these are the best kind of jobs because we have to go through bank accounts and we have to trace the money to the actual pay down of the mortgage, which if we're talking about a joint bank account, after the date of marriage, all the earnings become community property.
Unless I presume, or can you enter into a prenuptial agreement and the earnings will remain separate, or is that wrong?
Absolutely. You can contract out of any element of California law, so that is something. A prenuptial agreement can impact the nature of the relationship between the parties and how they decide to characterize income or any asset in the marriage.
Yes, that's true. It doesn't happen very often where that, you know, you have to jump through the hoops.
I mean, I think, wasn't that part of a Lee Marvin problem that he had with his former other?
Well, Lee Marvin was a different circumstance because they didn't get married. So the issue there was whether or not the spouse, per se, was entitled to any support because there was no marriage and therefore there would be no community property and there would be no entitlement to spousal support.
Correct.
Well, let me come back to you, Lisa. I cut you off. Go ahead with respect to the property we're talking about.
Right. So we're now a community estate. We're creating wealth, and that wealth is now paying down this mortgage of a separate property owner, of the one of the parties. One of the things we have to do is we have to track that money into the bank account, into the paying down of that mortgage. Mm-hmm. So if we have a situation, maybe there's commingling in the bank account where prior to marriage, maybe there was a separate property, some separate property funds that were transferred into that account. So essentially what we have to do is we have to track the money to see what dollar went and paid for that debt. And if it turned out to be a community dollar, then that community dollar starts to generate ownership in that asset for the community.
So you as, and I think if you don't mind, I think most people would understand this, but I want to make sure they do. You're a CPA, certified public accountant, but also a forensic accountant. What does that mean?
Excuse me. Just what it sounds like. We go in and we dig for facts. Clients will come to us. They're referred to us. We come in on part of a team in a divorce, and we start to handle the financial pieces. And depending upon the assignment, we investigate. We investigate the bank accounts to figure out if there is an issue of commingling of funds. Mm-hmm. So,
separate and community property.
Correct. Or we have to go in and determine what is income for purposes of determining a support award, which might require us to delve into, say, we have a situation where there's a self-employed individual party. They might be writing off a lot of personal expenses in the business, which, quite frankly, the community benefited from in prior years, but now we no longer have a community. Now we're talking about a divorce situation. And we are asked to go in and investigate the expenses to see if there were actually valid business expenses. So it's what it entails is being a detective with the financial piece.
Is there a situation where people who are self-employed and have a business where they're actually taking money and not reporting it to the IRS? And if that is the case, how do you find when they're keeping the money under the table? Or putting it under the table, how do you find that out? Because that would relate to the assets that the other spouse would be entitled to share.
Well, I've seen those kind of circumstances fairly often with people who have cash businesses. And most often, both parties know that that's the kind of business that it is.
Ah, okay.
And so they are not necessarily inclined to have that heard before a court. And a lot of times those kind of cases can be settled because people are talking about the amount of money that is in fact available to the family, even if it's not reflected on a tax return.
And if they were to tell the truth, they could be well prosecuted by the IRS.
Mm-hmm. They could criminally. both potentially have a problem.
Yeah.
Both parties.
So they want to keep that.
Definitely. I did have a situation where there was $400,000 found in the wall of a house, which the other spouse did not know about, so that turned out to be beneficial.
The other spouse did not know about
this? No. The parties split up, and I don't know how they went into the wall.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's
significant cash.
But you don't know how they found the money in the wall?
I'm not quite sure how they discovered.
I think that's fantastic.
I'd like to find that in my wall.
Yeah, I would too. See, I'm going to start tearing out the walls in my house now. Okay, so you have available to you, Yasmin, as the attorney, when you start a case where there are, let's say, significant assets, you may believe, because of the discussion you've had with your client, let's say if you don't mind my saying it, and so I'm not looked upon as being sexist, but let's say you're representing the wife, it's the husband who's the major earner of the income, you kind of are starting to get a feel that maybe this guy, depending on what your client is saying, is hiding assets. How do you go about, for example, he's just talking about bank accounts. Let's say this guy may have set up bank accounts in his own name only, as opposed to being in joint tenancy with his wife. How do you go about finding that out?
Well,
if he's tried to hide it.
One of the things that happens in every divorce is what we call an exchange of disclosure, and that's mandatory before any divorce can be granted. And that exchange of disclosure involves an exchange between the parties of three different documents. There's a declaration of disclosure, there's an income and expense statement, and there's a schedule of assets and debts.
All under penalty of perjury, I assume.
They are. That's right. Correct. Mm-hmm. All three of them are separately signed under penalty of perjury.
Right.
And those documents, I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of looking at them, but they're very detailed.
Thank God, no.
Right.
Not yet, anyway.
And not only do they involve the completion of the documents, but they also have attachments that are required. And that really is part of the fiduciary duty that I referenced earlier that the parties have towards one another, is a full and frank exchange of that information. Mm-hmm. So that is kind of the first step that takes place. And if it is a situation where there's significant assets or fairly complex assets, then I would involve someone like Lisa to help the client perhaps prepare those documents and then also be involved in reviewing the documents that we receive from the other side. Because all of the assets are listed on there, and then there are attachments which will include, for example, property titles or statements from retirement accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So that starts to give you an initial picture of what the estate looks like, what all of the assets, not only community assets, but also separate property assets, what those are.
Mm-hmm.
Once we've exchanged those, then...
So if I may interrupt you for just a moment. So someone who is the owner of separate property also has the obligation under the fiduciary disclosure requirement to make known what those separate properties are on these documents.
Absolutely. And in fact, both parties have the obligation to list what they each think that both and each of them own.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's good.
That, you know, oftentimes someone will say, well, I know that the other side has a Bank of America account. I don't know anything about it. I don't know how much is in it. I don't know what the address of the bank is, but I know that they have a Bank of America account. So on that disclosure, they might write Bank of America account, you know, location unknown or funds unknown.
Mm-hmm.
But it notifies the other party that, you know, I know you have that account, and I'm looking forward to getting that information.
How do you find that out, though, where the account is? Let's say it is a Bank of America account.
Well, the first level is to see what is disclosed initially by the other
side.
Let's
say it's not specifically disclosed by the other side.
So if it's not specifically disclosed, then the next level, once we have exchanged that, would be to go through some of the tools that we have to get information in the divorce. And there are a variety of them. So, for example...
The rack and the screw? Is that one of them?
That might be. It depends on what
Maybe
the answer is afterwards.
Maybe it should be, huh?
I recommend
that. All right.
So, for example, there is, under the Code of Civil Procedure, an opportunity to ask for what we call a demand for production or inspection of documents. And that is a form of formal, we call it discovery, which is an attempt to get information from the other side in a formal fashion. Mm-hmm. And I should step back one moment, because a lot of times in family law, people try to do informal discovery first. Mm-hmm. And that is when counsel, for example, are meeting and conferring to say, look, can we set a date to exchange bank accounts, credit card mm-hmm. statements, mm-hmm. the documents that they think are relevant to that particular family? And most family counsel are pretty good about meeting and conferring and trying to do informal discovery. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can't happen, and that can be for a variety of reasons. So then you have to go to the next level, which is formal discovery. It's written, it's propounded on the other side, they have a certain time period by which they have to respond, and they have to get you the information that you request. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in that demand for documents, for example, you might say, all right, I want to get all of the bank accounts, either that are in your name, any business name that you own, that you mm-hmm. have jointly with my client or with any other party. So mm-hmm. you can craft it as broadly as you think you need to. Mm-hmm. So you can ask for records related to the business. And that's where Lisa's help is key, because she can say, all right, these are a list of 15 documents that I think you should be requesting, so that her involvement is there from the beginning, at the outset, when we're asking for the documents from the other side.
How do you know, though, Lisa, that you want, let's say, as Yasmin has mentioned, 15 documents, how do you know you want those 15 documents?
Which documents I want?
Yeah, how do you know that?
I will first go to the tax return.
So you will get tax returns
ahead
of time.
Tax returns are very helpful.
Because certainly the client, Yasmin's client, we would hope, a copy of the tax returns.
Often they don't, actually.
They don't even have the tax returns.
You know, often, many times I see someone has signed a return and they don't have a copy of it.
How do you do that then, Lisa?
We're just talking about a general request. If we don't have any specific information, then we'll just make a general request, like the documents that Yasmin mentioned. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, any bank account that you have ownership in or mm-hmm. have the benefit of. Mm-hmm. So if it becomes a general request, anything you think that's a financial document, it depends on, you know, if it's a business, then we're going to also request the Quicken report, the general ledger, depending upon
what type, is the Quicken report?
How they keep their books.
Their bookkeeping. Okay. I got you. Mm-hmm.
And it may be that depending on the documents you get out of that document demand, you have follow-up. Mm-hmm. Either discovery that you want to do, either another document demand, mm-hmm. or you want to take a deposition, mm-hmm. or you want to... A deposition, by the way, it's like an interrogation under oath. Mm-hmm. So you have the other person sitting there and they're being cross-examined as to a variety of questions.
It's not fun for...
Yeah, I don't think that most people would enjoy that process.
No, it's not fun. Let me interrupt you for a moment. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program, at least in the first half hour, focusing on dissolution of marriage, which also is known as divorce, where one or the other spouse, the divorcing spouse, has hidden some assets, or we think has hidden some assets, and we're talking about what can be done to try to find those assets in terms of the division of property once the case comes to an end. My guests are... actually, a couple of very experienced people. Lisa Jodakor, who's a CPA and forensic accountant, and Yasmin Mehmet, a certified family law specialist. She's a member of the executive committee of the family law section of the state bar. Okay, let's come back. I'm sorry for interrupting, but I wanted to let people know who may have come in just a little bit late to hear you. Do you have difficulty if there is... let's say, a nefarious spouse who has a separate bank account, who has not told, let's say, his spouse about mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm. Is there a way, as you, as an experienced forensic accountant, have been able to find that?
Ferret that out?
Yeah.
Well...
You have a pet ferret, do you, that helps you on this?
Yeah. No, that you have to have some clues, uh-huh. something. You have to have a straw to go to.
So if there's an account in the Seychelles Islands, that's mm-hmm. kind of hard to find, probably.
Yeah, huh? Although I have come across cases where, you know, looking at in this particular case, it was a venture fund, and looking at the financial statements and looking at the footnotes in the financial statements, I was able to see that they had some overseas activity in the Bahamas that led to some significant issues in the case. So,
and if a party
gotta have a string
who has an account in the Bahamas, let's say refuses, just does not want to reveal this. How do you deal with that, Yasmin? How do you deal with that person?
Well,
is that person subject to contempt of court?
I mean, our pet ferret is probably named Subpoena, so you know that's the way that you're going to try to get that information. You know, we were talking about the Bank of America account earlier.
Excellent, excellent. I was going to ask the name of Lisa's ferret, but I got it now. But go ahead.
So that is one way that you can get that kind of information. The other is you subpoena
what?
You can subpoena a bank, for example.
Bank.
If you know that, where you have a belief that Bank of America has accounts that have not been disclosed to you in the exchange of disclosure, the bank has an obligation to give that information.
Yeah. Even if the account might be, I mean, your action is filed in California. If the account is, let's say, in some other state, but you find out it's of a Bank of America account or whatever it is, but it's in another state, you have the power under the law in California to require that the bank will produce those records?
Well, that can become more complex because then you have issues of jurisdiction of the court here.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I was going to say that you can do is if you have somebody, I mean, this is not an ordinary kind of case. This is a case where somebody is probably flying internationally. So you have some clues that they have a level of sophistication and a level of ability to conduct these kind of international transactions.
Mm-hmm.
For example, what you can do is you can have depositions of other people that are in the company. You know, you can start asking questions of other people who are around the person who doesn't want to admit anything.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because not a lot of people are prepared to put their own reputation at stake under oath.
Sure.
You know, it's the kind of thing that even sometimes issuing those subpoenas can get you some answers that you weren't able to get earlier.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. So most kinds of money hiding, most kinds of really intentional non-disclosure has a paper trail.
Mm-hmm.
So it's trying to find the place that paper trail starts or getting somewhere into the middle of it. And I think that Lisa's saying right, and that's what she's probably seen in her experience.
Let me ask
you both
this. Those cases that you both handled where there has been a hiding of assets, what kind of personality or personalities do these people have? No, I'm serious. I mean, is this
controlling?
I would think very controlling. That this person does not want the other spouse to really fully know what's going on. So
they're kept in the dark. They're completely
like that.
They
like
in the dark.
You know, that's what a strange relationship to have with your spouse. You know.
It is.
This person you sleep with every night, supposedly.
But, you know, people conduct their relationships differently. So I have to say I don't feel try not to judge those circumstances because people live very differently. And the difficulty is they may want to live one way while they're married. That carrying on of the relationship, that can change when the relationship is over.
Oh, sure.
So it's just like with spousal support where people will say, my partner wanted to support me during the marriage, but now they don't want to anymore. So people have a certain expectation of how things have been, and some people want to carry that expectation into the future, and it just doesn't happen that way. Once people are divorced, they have a whole different set of expectations of their spouse.
What recommendations do you have? And I don't want to have people start unnecessarily suspecting their spouse as being...
It's not a good thing.
Actually, what I was going to say on that point just is that sometimes people find out that their belief is not only unfounded, but in fact, they don't have the level of assets that they believed they had. So you can have circumstances where people believe that they're living a very glamorous lifestyle and they have a lot of assets, but that house of cards can fall after the divorce action is filed because they realize they'll be living on credit, for example.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And they were kept in the dark and, you know, maybe that was the nature of the relationship at that point. Mm-hmm. So that can lead to certain suspicions when all of a sudden at the end of the relationship, they realize that, well, wait a minute, why are there no assets listed on this disclosure document? But that may in fact be the case.
What recommendation do you have? I mean, obviously, no one is perfect. There are people who have long-term marriages. I mean, what's the divorce rate today in California? 50%+?
I would believe it's probably 50%. I don't think I've heard anything different than that.
Yeah, I've never heard anything different than that. Well, what recommendations would both of you have, if any, in terms of what, let's say, if one spouse is the major income earner and the other spouse is let's say, maybe has a job, maybe not making much money, or perhaps is an in-home person taking care of the kids. Usually it's the mother or the wife or the mother. Sometimes it's, I guess, rarely the man. I mean, we could have people who are, have partnerships, who are lesbians or gay people. I mean, they can have the same problem.
Sure.
What recommendations do you have for people so that they feel a little bit more comfortable, if they're listening to this program, feel a little bit more comfortable about the financial situation of their relationship, mm-hmm. whether they have a regular marriage or it's a partnership through the state, whether they're lesbians or gays or whatever. Do you have any recommendations that they might do to try to be better knowledgeable, Lisa?
Yeah. When they sign that tax return, if they're signing a tax return, know it's on the tax return. Ask questions.
So read it.
Read
it.
Don't just sign it. You know,
point.
The tax return tells you a lot. It tells you income. It tells you assets. Mm-hmm. Ask questions. Mm-hmm. Ask questions. Ask, what was sold? Why do we have capital gain? What was sold? Okay, mm-hmm. that's some stock. So we must have a brokerage account. Can you show me the brokerage statement? Mm-hmm. Just ask questions. You know, if
good communication is what's very important, obviously.
It's communication, but it's also not giving someone else total control of your financial situation.
Yeah. That's right. I think that's a two-way street.
Don't give your spouse, the key is don't give your spouse total control.
But, I think people also need to have the belief and knowledge that they themselves can get this information.
Yeah.
So don't feel I'm not smart enough to understand
it.
You know, I'm not educated. I don't have the language ability, whatever it is. You do have that ability, and you can ask those questions that Lisa's referring to and really be a proponent of informing yourself.
We are coming to the end of the statewide version of the program. For those of you who listen to us live in the Bay Area or live on the internet at www.kalw.org, we will continue for an additional half hour and you'll have a chance to call in. It is about 7:28 at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. I would like to invite you to call in if you have a question in the area of assets or divorce, and I hope you don't, in terms of your own personal situation, but this particular program is funded by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, which has actually been funding this program, I think, at least close to 20 years. We've had a wonderful relationship. In this last year, Yasmin has been incredibly helpful in suggesting ideas, topics, guests, etc. And so I want to give you our phone number here, 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134, if you would like to call in with either a question regarding assets. Do you mind if they call and ask a question about some other area?
No,
of family
no problems
law? Yeah. And by the way, for those of you who are listening, next week we're going to talk about child support. And I'm going to have a couple of people, actually four guests, a couple of people from the San Mateo County Child Support Services Office, and then a couple of attorneys who are family law attorneys to focus on that. It's just kind of a coincidence that we are doing this, but to let you know, in case you're having a problem with you're getting child support for your child, you're the parent who has the child with you, but the non-custodial parent isn't paying. We'll be talking about what you may be able to do there. So on this segment of the program, my guests are Yasmin Mehmet. She's a certified family law specialist, certified by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. She's a member of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar. Her offices are in San Francisco. My other guest is Lisa Jolicoeur. That's French, isn't it?
That is.
It's a lovely
Thank you.
Lovely last name.
That's the only
name.
French I know.
Is it real? Oh, too bad, too bad. She's a CPA and a forensic accountant, and her offices are in San Francisco. So if you'd like to call in, please do, and we'll have a chance to talk with you, hopefully, and give you some kind of thoughts. One of the things, Lisa, that you mentioned before we went on the air, that can be very revealing if someone is trying to have control over the other spouse and mm-hmm. trying to hide things. If there has been an application for a loan.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about that, would you, before we take our first call?
Well, you know, a loan application, ostensibly they're going to be honest on the loan application because most of that stuff can be double-checked. So if you have a loan application that, say, you're listing your assets at a value that, you know, maybe you have a business that you're listing at, you know, $10 million. But in the disclosures that we've talked about, maybe he's listed the asset and has claimed the asset is worth only $1 million. Mm-hmm. So there's a disparity, an obvious disparity. That's something you would try and ferret out in terms mm-hmm. of why does he think that value. I mean, obviously, if we're talking about a business, we're going to go out and get a business valuation brought in. But
what does that mean, a business valuation? Well, some other expert who evaluates businesses?
I value businesses.
Oh, you do?
Yeah,
also.
In a divorce situation. So
what does that mean by a business evaluation? Business valuation?
Basically, value the business.
Really?
The business.
Right. It's like you would be valuing the fair market value of a home for sale or
that's
something
correct.
Like that.
That's correct. That's correct. So there's some information that's provided by the spouse in mm-hmm. a situation where you do a business valuation. So you would want to ask the question, why on the loan application you're listing the asset at $10 million in terms of that value mm-hmm. compared to the value you're listing on your disclosure. There's mm-hmm. information that you have that you're not sharing.
Mm-hmm.
So that just kind of, it's another one of those things that perks your ears up and you're saying, something's not right here. And you know, you want to think everybody's being honest and straightforward. And stuff like that, when that happens, you have to...
You know that there's
something going on.
Something going on there.
Something going on.
All right. Let's do this. George, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hello.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Your turn.
Oh, thank you. So, listen, I'm involved in a divorce. Well, actually, a friend of mine is. And what happens when the spouse is bound and determined not to cooperate and to be dishonest, you know, as far as paying spousal support, doesn't pay even though there's a court order, self-employed with a professional corporation, and we can't, you know, find bank accounts, or if we do, they're in the name of the corporation and they can't be attached. Those kind of things. I mean, you know, game-playing, filing bankruptcy, mm-hmm. Lying, just not wanting to pay. Is there anything that's available?
Are you saying, George, for sure this person who you're referring to has actually filed bankruptcy?
Oh, yeah, Chapter 7. The person is a doctor who makes a lot of money. I mean, he makes, you know, over $500,000 a year. He doesn't want to pay. And he's just using every game in the book to delay. And he
is, of course, represented by an attorney, I presume. Is he, George? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Is the doctor represented by an attorney?
He has all kinds of attorneys, bankruptcy attorneys.
Oh, brother.
You know, he's basically dishonest and is bound and determined not to
pay. Boy, I wouldn't want him for my doctor, I'll tell you that.
Well, let me
get some comments. Obviously, this is something that's a very complicated question. If you're dealing with someone who has that kind of lack of honesty, but what comments do you have about that?
Well, first of all, if he's claiming he has no money, we know he has to have some form of compensation to live. So what's his lifestyle like? And if he has an extravagant lifestyle and it's in conflict with what he's saying his financial situation is, what we're definitely going to be looking at will be his bank accounts. What's going through his bank account? What's going through the business bank accounts? How is he living?
He's using his corporation as his checkbook. And, you know, because his corporation is a separate legal entity, the court order is only to him, but he doesn't take any money out of it. And it's kind of a frustrating situation. He just throws up roadblocks, and the courts are so slow that they don't, you know, he'll go to court if he has to, and then he'll say, well, this is not true, and then they set a hearing for 6 months later.
George, if I may interrupt for a moment, is he still licensed as a medical doctor?
Yes, definitely.
Is he aware that if he pulls this kind of stunt and, let's say, doesn't pay child support, that he could possibly lose his license?
Well, I don't know if he can. It's actually...
Well, that is part of California law.
Well, so how does one pursue that?
Well, we're going to talk about that next week, if you'd like to join us then, because I will have the representatives of the San Mateo County Child Support Services department on the program to talk specifically about this kind of stuff. But, Yasmin, what comments do you have for George?
I think the reality is it's going to be a more difficult and complex case to pursue, but there are avenues that can be taken. If there are arrearages of child support, you will have the opportunity to hear more details about this next week. But the Department of Child Support Service has a mandate to pursue those arrears, and they have a variety of tools that they can use that private attorneys don't have.
Yeah.
So not only the business license, but they can also take driver's license, they can take passports, so they can really restrict him in his ability to be mobile and to practice. The other thing,
does that apply to spousal support as well as child?
I don't think that they're pursuing spousal support in that fashion now. I think that may be something that is going to happen if it's coupled with child support in the future. I understand that's something that they're talking about now. The other piece is you can look at a contempt application. Mm-hmm. And for a medical doctor to be facing contempt application, that's something that really can also cause problems for him. Because the court has a broad range of remedies that it can pursue on a contempt application.
We're going to move on, George, because...
Well, thank you.
You might want to join us next week, because we will be talking about much about this type of thing. But obviously, for your friend who is on the other side, it sounds like she's dealing with somebody who is... going to the extreme to try to win, a true controller type. So thanks very much for calling, George. Take care now. All right, Julie, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi.
Hi.
This is kind of more of a question. It's not necessarily a divorce situation, but my husband and I had a business, and we didn't go bankrupt because I just found that with the lawyers and everything, with the chapter, the way they do Chapter 7 and stuff, it didn't make any financial sense, actually. So we just closed our businesses.
Mm-hmm.
But we're looking at maybe, selling things. And at this point in time, we bought a warehouse in San Francisco, and he paid for it at the time because he could afford it. And he then placed it into a retirement fund.
Ouch.
And I'm just was curious as to...
Well, let me get Lisa to comment on that. Another one of these things. Have you, by the way, Julie, have you and your husband contacted a lawyer to try to get some advice?
Not on the retirement fund.
Well, it may be that you might want to do it. But let me do this. Before Lisa responds, let me just mention to you one of the funders of this program is the San Francisco Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service. I'm a great believer in people trying to educate themselves, at least in contacting lawyer referral and trying to get at least an initial consultation so that they might have some inkling of what to do. And
best $35 you'll spend.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrific deal. So let me just mention this, and then Lisa will respond. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KLW listeners like you. If you are in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours, of course, and you'll usually speak to a human being And that number is 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. And if you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own, again, during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone experienced and set you up for a half an hour consultation. Depending on the county, for half an hour, it could be a low of $25 or maybe a high of $35. It does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service because it is a consumer service. Now to you, Lisa.
Thank you.
What comments do you have?
Well, my first question for Julie is the warehouse intended to be used by you and your husband?
Well, it's... Since we have no income, and that's where our business was, and it would be great to be able to utilize it in some kind of renting situation. But because I understand that the bylaws with the taxes around the retirement, that we would be basically taking, it would be some kind of violation on
correct.
The tax.
Correct, and that's why I said, ouch. You cannot use an asset inside of a retirement for your self-benefit. You'd run into... unrelated business tax issues, and this isn't my specialty. I just do know this, so I think just be aware of that. You should not use any type of asset in a retirement account for your personal benefit. You run into some big trouble. So, was that your specific question, or maybe I misheard you?
Well, yeah, finding out a little bit. I mean, just a little bit. You know, just to clarify that is the case, and then. And then if we sold it, what would the impact, would that be also like taking out an IRA SEP early before he is, I don't know what the age is, 60, I think it is, 62?
Okay, so if you...
I don't know what the retirement age, I can't...
It's 59 and a half.
59 and a half.
Yeah, so if you have the warehouse inside a retirement asset and you sell the warehouse while it's still in the retirement asset, you won't have any gain on that sale, which is a good thing.
Right.
Once you do that, your retirement account will have cash and you can start taking distributions. How old is your husband?
He's actually getting up there. I think he's 56.
Oh, okay.
How old is he?
He's getting up there. 66.
66. Okay. All right.
So you can start taking withdrawals.
Yeah.
But
be nice to the old guy, will you?
But stay away from use. You know, I don't know if you've used the asset in the past and what your situation is, but remember that's an asset of the retirement account. It's not a personal asset of your own. But once you do sell that asset and it turns into cash, you can start taking withdrawals out.
Who should they go and see? I mean, this is a significant... How much did you and your husband pay for this warehouse?
This was one of those things.
Ooh, hey. Julie, does this guy have a girlfriend? I just have to pull your chain on that one. You know, both of you really need to get, you know, this is probably a valuable asset and you really need to get some good advice on it.
Definitely.
Who should they see?
Yeah, you know, I wish I could give you the name of, I went to a class a couple of weeks ago and somebody spoke on this subject, so I don't have the name. I could, if you look me up and contact me, I can certainly forward.
May I give your office
yes,
number,
definitely.
If you don't mind? Let me give you, are you ready to write, Julie?
I am. I'm ready to write. Thank you.
Yeah, make sure you got a pen that works.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. Lisa Jolicoeur. And let me spell it because I love to pronounce her name, but let me spell it for you. Jolicoeur. Did you get it?
Yes.
Okay, here's her phone number in San Francisco. 415-321-4933.
4933.
Okay, you might give her a call and see who it was that...
Give me a call.
Give her a call and she'll give you a name, okay?
Okay, I'm going to just repeat that number. Just
yeah, read it back.
321-4933.
You got it.
That's it.
You got it. And if for any reason you have it written it down incorrectly, you can call me at my office at the San Mateo County DA's office.
Okay, great.
And I'll give you the number, okay?
Okay.
All right, take care. Thanks for calling. And in fairness to my other great guest here, I have to give her phone number. Yasmin Mehmet, her number 415-981-0330. 415-981-0330.
Don't call to ask me about retirement.
No, she's not going to tell you about that, but I just wanted to be fair.
Won't be helpful there.
All right, now, this is a real challenge for me. By the way, for those of you who tune in late, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. My guests are Yasmin Mehmet, a certified family law specialist, member of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and Lisa Jodeker, CPA and forensic accountant. And our next caller is Rigosh. Is that correct?
Rigosh.
Okay, you're on.
Okay, thank you.
Your turn. Yeah, you're on the air.
Thank you, yeah. So there was a marriage only for, like, we stayed together for a few months and we separated due to some differences, and we did file for the divorce right away. Now, my question is whether the date of separation will be from the time we physically separated and she moved to another country, or will it be the time we file it? Because I guess that is the one that will determine the assets, and like how many assets were procured during that duration. So
that's very interesting. So you're wondering if you have assets that have increased since splitting, what the law requires. Now, was your marriage, you were married in California?
No, it wasn't in California. It was in another country.
Oh, well, would California law apply here, Yasmin, for them?
Well, California has jurisdiction over a marriage if the parties have been residing in California for 6 months.
Have you been residing here together for 6 months?
Not together. I've been residing for definitely more than years.
So only one party has to be resident in California.
So can you give him a basic, by the way, Rikosh, you don't have a lawyer yet, right?
No.
Okay, don't be foolish. You know, don't think you can do this on your own, because you can make some major mistakes. And I just gave, where do you live? What city?
Santa Clara.
Okay, well, you should, my suggestion is you should contact the Santa Clara County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service just to have an initial half-hour consultation with a family lawyer. But okay. And the other thing that I want to tell you is, because the major funder of this program is the State Bar of California, and my guest, Yasmin, is a member of the State Bar, I'm a member of the State Bar, the bar does not permit my guest to give specific legal advice. So I will ask Yasmin to do is to give you some basic general information that might get you headed in the right direction. But at this point, it seems to me you have kind of a potentially explosive question with regard to assets, and you need to get some good legal advice. But Yasmin, what comment do you have for him?
Well, in terms of date of separation, just as general advice, what the court looks at is to determine whether or not the marriage is what we call irretrievably broken. And the timing of when it is irretrievably broken is when one has expressed to the other that the marriage is finally over. So there can be a number of indicators of that. Certainly moving out of the property is one, and it's a fairly significant one in the case law. There can be the filing of the dissolution can be another indicator of when the marriage was broken. But the circumstances of any particular couple can also change that date. So, for example, sometimes people will file and they will have a subsequent reconciliation, which can impact whether or not they are, in fact, separated. So the court can look at a broad set of circumstances to know whether or not both or one party has expressed to the other that the marriage is over. You don't have marital relations, for example, or you don't represent yourself to other people as being a couple. So there are a lot of fairly fact-specific circumstances that a lawyer would look at to know whether you have, in fact, separated at any particular point in time. And sometimes people have a disagreement about that. One will say, I think that the marriage was over in April, and the other will say, no, I didn't believe that. I thought we were still trying to stay together as a couple, and I believed that until at least September. So there can be some factual dispute between parties about when that date is. So then the court looks at those kind of factors that I mentioned to determine objectively when the date of separation might have been.
So does that help you to get some idea of what you got to do now?
Yeah, definitely. So it seems like since we had some kind of negotiation about splitting up, I can definitely use it as a proof to get the date of separation as when we split up. Instead of, only mistake we did was we didn't file the whole process due to some other complication.
It'll be a factor that the court would probably consider. So without knowing the details of your circumstances and what was said between the two of you, it normally is a factor that the court's going to take into consideration in deciding what the date of separation would be, if it's disputed.
I see. Okay.
And we're going to move on because we've got some other callers. Thank you very much for calling. But
Very quick. That's a very important question. So in California, they have a clause for annulment of marriage. Now, since this was only for a few months, does it qualify, or can you give me an idea on what clauses will qualify for annulment versus dissolution or divorce?
Oh, annulment of marriage. Annulment of marriage is under very limited grounds, so it tends to be incapacity or an inability to contract in the contract of the marriage. So, for example, if one of you was married at the time, insanity, incurable insanity is another ground for annulment. There are very limited handful of circumstances, and for that you definitely should consult an attorney if you think that you may have some facts to show that any of those grounds are present.
Where is your wife, Rigosh?
She's in India.
Okay, all right. Well, I do suggest that at the very least you contact the Santa Clara County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service, ask to have an appointment, half an hour consultation at least with a family lawyer, family law attorney, and try to get some answers to your questions. Good luck to you.
Yeah, so you said only one.
No, we're going to move on. We're going to move on, Rigosh. I've told you what you should do, and please follow through. Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. All right, Susie, thank you for waiting. Welcome to your legal rights.
Are you talking to me?
Of course. Is your name Susie?
Yeah.
Yeah, Susie, you're on, my dear.
I'm not sure what specific question I have. I'm going through a divorce, and it's been almost 2 years since my husband left the marriage. Since he left, I have found out that he has under-declared income by, for example, 2010, over $100,000 a year.
Ouch.
And, you know, what I've found out since he left is that he defrauded my entire marriage.
Ooh.
Oops.
Oh.
And I have no lawyer. He's hiding all his income. This has just been so...
You are, Susie, if I may interrupt for a moment, you are still legally married?
Yes.
You are. In what city?
I live in the East Bay.
And where does he live?
Alameda County. We both live in Alameda County.
Do you? Have you contacted by any chance the Alameda County Bar Association?
Yeah, I mean, this has been going on 2 years. I've been pretty much pro per the entire time.
But what I'm asking is, have you contacted the
yes,
the Bar Association? Are you working?
No.
And how do you live? How do you live?
He's been giving me some money. I have a lot of. I believe part of why he left the marriage is that I had some. I'm getting older. And I had a long-term neck injury that has gotten worse and worse. And in 2010, I had another crisis with my neck. And I think he decided that, you know, since I was going to need some medical costs, that he didn't love me anymore.
Wow, he's a real...
I suppose if I had had cancer, he would have allowed me to die.
Well, that would have been nice of him. He sounds like a real winner. The reason I suggest you, and maybe you've exhausted this, but you know there are some attorneys who will help people on a pro bono basis, but also in a situation like this, even though you don't have money to hire an attorney, the court can order that your husband pay your attorney's fees.
That's right.
I did file an ex parte and a notice of motion. I got $2,500. Then when I exhausted that and I went back to court with a notice of motion, he literally had his lawyer quit to pretend that he was broke.
Oh, my.
So that I wouldn't be allowed any money.
You know, Susie, you really have to, I mean, this guy is just too much. He's really too much. I really feel that you need to get back in touch, and maybe Yasmin has some great ideas on this, but I really think you need to get back in touch with the Alameda County Bar Association to see if they can't help you find an attorney who's willing to take on your case with the idea that, your husband is obviously a crook. He really is.
Yeah, I also have proof that he's defrauding all of our creditors.
And oh, wonderful.
He thought he was going to file bankruptcy, and then I started researching bankruptcy because I really didn't know anything about it.
Desmond, do you have some comments for Susie?
Well, I just very broadly, when you say that you know he has under-declared income by $100,000 per year, I'm not sure what the nature was of your motion for attorney's fees, but if his...
That was before I knew how much money.
Okay.
So then I would refile that motion because Family Code Section 2030 is pretty strong in terms of getting funds for one party when there's a disparity of income.
Yeah.
And if you don't have income, then you should refile that motion and reinstate the request to the court to have him pay attorney's fees. And at that point, you can give the information that you have about what the assets are that you believe he has and any underreporting that you believe is taking place.
Yasmin, Susie believes that, you know, she's improper. And yet, certainly the little bit I know, you know, I'm not a family lawyer. You're incredibly experienced. Does she not have, if she puts a little more effort into this again, the right to have an attorney who will seek to get compensated through the court by her husband for attorney's fees or not?
Well, does she have the right to have it? I think that she may be able to find an attorney who would be willing to do that for her because the attorney, if the attorney has information that leads him or her to believe that there are assets from the other side, then they would have some expectation that they would be able to get paid by the other side.
Yeah.
There actually is a project right now that I can't speak much to, but it's a civil Gideon project where they're actually trying to find a test case where they can have somebody go into the family court and say that they should be entitled to get a family law attorney because it's a constitutional right.
Well, that's interesting.
Equal to other rights like a criminal proceeding.
Under the constitutional, the Gideon case.
That's right.
So who might she get in touch with to see if she might be the right one to be involved with this project?
Probably contact me. I was at a meeting recently where people were talking about this project.
Susie, do you have a pen that works?
Yep.
All right, get ready. You ready?
Yes.
415-981-0330.
Okay.
For Yasmin Mehmet. M-E-H-M-E-T.
M-E-H?
M-E-T. M-E-H-M-E-T. Yeah, yeah. So good luck to you. I think we're just about over, unfortunately, with the program. Susie, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
All right, I want to thank you both very much.
Thank you.
The time went too fast.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your wonderful information that you've given us. My guests have been Yasmin Mehmet, Certified Family Law Specialist and member of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar with offices in San Francisco, and Lisa Jolicoeur, CPA and forensic accountant with offices in San Francisco. Thank you both very much. Your Legal Rights production staff members are Joanne Marr, engineer, and program assistant is Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, we're going to be talking again about family law, but this time we'll focus on child support issues. My guests will be Ileana Rodriguez, Director, and Trinidad Madrigal, Staff Attorney for the San Mateo County Department of Child Support Services, and family law attorneys Robert Bruning and Esther Rosenfeld. So I hope you join me then. Thank you very much for joining us on Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney.